Welcome to The Gauge, a podcast brought to you by Green Gauge, the first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. Today, Sean Kiernan, CEO of Green Gauge, speaks to John Pepin, Chief Executive at Philanthropy Impact, about philanthropy, cryptocurrency, and generational giving. John speaks about how he became interested in crypto and what does it mean for the future of philanthropy. How can professional advisors guide donors on this giving journey, especially in digital assets, which is a very new field? And they ask, in an industry which prides itself on doing good, does anyone know how much impact investing is really taking place within crypto?
John, it's a real treat to have you with us today on The Gauge. It's been an honor to get to know you this past year and also to join Philanthropy Impact. What I'd love to hear is from you directly about the theme of crypto for good, what Philanthropy Impact is, and who you are.
Okay, well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. You've been really supportive of the work that we've been doing and personally as well, so I really appreciate that. Okay, Philanthropy Impact is quite unique. Not in terms of its end, because its end is we want money for good. We want to increase the flow of capital, whether that's philanthropy, venture philanthropy, ESG or impact investing, so across the spectrum of capital. Our uniqueness is that we work with private client professional advisors to high net worth and ultra high net worth individuals. And that would be tax, private banks, legal, wealth managers, et cetera. And what we do is we try to encourage them to have conversations about their clients, about their values, their motivations and ambitions, because that's what's now being demanded by Gen Z, according to our research, and we can talk about that a little later, millennials, women of wealth, but also now boomers, some research coming out about that. And what we do is we run educational opportunities, so events, so if you want to look at some of the events, you can go on YouTube and look up Philanthropy Impact, there's still a bunch of stuff there. We share intelligence, we do specific training that's CPT certified, CISI endorsed, and we have a magazine, et cetera. So that's what we do. In our training, we try to give the advisors the ability to have these conversations, and we give courage, competence, and opportunity. This is a commercial opportunity that a lot of advisors are missing. So that's us.
One thing that connected us initially was a sense of curiosity.
Yes.
And you came and we had a fantastic initial discussion around the metaverse and Web3 and crypto. And you were thinking, how is this going to impact what I do as an advisor to the advisors, if you will, to support philanthropy and generating impact? And I know we recently had a breakfast to bring some pretty interesting people together with the theme of crypto for good. I'd love to hear kind of your thoughts and the discovery of how you came to seeking that breakfast and then what you found from it.
I'll take a little step back. In running the organization, we have a lot of very traditional approaches to what we're doing and effective in nature. But I think that we should always be looking at not just what we're doing, but also what the potential future is. So we did some research and looked at things that we could do to improve over the next 2 or 3 years. So improving the customer experience, improving social media, et cetera, et cetera. But that's okay, that's the next couple of years. But what's gonna go beyond that? And that's got me into the whole issue of the metaverse and what is involved with that, crypto. And so I thought, well, we should be taking a look at that, because if our approach is in the traditional finance area, in the traditional wealth management area, then that's fine. But there's a lot of money and activity outside of that in the crypto area. So I thought, well, if we're trying to get money for good, why not look at crypto for good? And that was the title of our breakfast and the title of an event we're going to have in the autumn about that. And then I thought, okay, so that gets us the next 2 or 3 to 4 or 5 years from now. Actually, some of it might be happening sooner than later, especially with the metaverse. And so we might adapt that to training, but we're taking a look at that. And then we started to look at quantum physics, and which is really quite fascinating. So I arranged an event that was looking at technology and the advisory marketplace. And then I found someone in Sweden who was actually working on some of this. So we had them come in by Zoom into the live event So we had very traditional stuff. And then I asked the chairs, one of the questions is, what is quantum computing? And so that was really quite fascinating. So we had the traditional stuff and we had this like up there, but it's not that far out there really, in terms of what this person was saying and how it could be used. So that we're monitoring that. We're not in any position to do anything about it now, plus it's not practical enough for what we do. So, but it's coming. So all right, so my idea is always to look into the future. It may or may not happen, but at least you're thinking about stuff that way you can improve the way you reach out to people. And I see the metaverse as we've been exploring now. I had some really interesting discussions yesterday about that and how we might be able to create a platform that could add a lot of value to the training that we're doing, because we could put people in the position of a Gen Z. And so they might actually, in the metaverse, I don't know if this is possible, but it's fun to play with the idea. So that's where it's coming from.
It's interesting that you frame it in those two streams, if I may, the one being engaging with technologies, and you broadened that to include quantum as a means to transform the delivery of what we do on a day-to-day basis. But the latter stream then being potentially as a source of, as you call it, money for good, new types of engagement to deliver good outcomes.
Yeah. If you think in terms of traditional wealth management and traditional philanthropy, there's a lot of it, still pretty small considered the amount of work wealth. So there's been recent studies that show that medium gift range, depending on the study, 500 to 4,000. Well, that means that half the wealthiest people give less than that. There's lots of room for growth, but that doesn't talk about the crypto area at all, where there's a lot of wealth. So why wouldn't we see that as a potential source of philanthropic giving, of social investment, and also impact investing? If we're going to look at sustainability, it's right across the spectrum. And I don't see crypto as being any different. And so that's what we did. And then we organized a breakfast with your help. And we had some really interesting people. So we had some professional advisors who were advising in that area. We had some crypto billionaires, but we just think they still were. Last year was a bit tough. And some other people in the room who, that was really a super breakfast discussion.
It was a lot of fun hearing as well the different viewpoints, because it wasn't doctrinaire. I mean, this was not a group of people that were Bitcoin bros, so to speak, but they were looking at a deeper level. One thing that I remarked at breakfast was the research you had done more broadly on Gen Z, millennials, and some of the giving patterns. And I think a lot of these new technologies, and also that framing, as you said, potentially the metaverse allows us to think through the lens of someone else.
Yes.
Could you talk to the research that you did and just some high-level themes that might be relevant for our audience?
Sure. We have a special group of wealth holders who are Gen Z and millennials, women of wealth. They're all under age 40. And it's really fascinating to be in discussions with them. And it's quite inspiring. At one point, I said some of them would have fit in well in the 60s and 70s and stuff. So it was really neat. What we decided to do late last year was to do a bit of informal research. So we hired a group to go out and to talk to 11 millennials, Gen Z, who were wealth holders. Well, I'm not part of a family where the head of the family is making all the decisions or whatever. And then as part of that, there's discussions about with 9 professional advisors. And what came out of the study was, we reinforced what we're hearing a lot, but I don't think that a lot of advisors are sort of picking up on it. And I think the same thing will apply to crypto, although it's probably more up to date in technology and use of technology for communicating. But what came out of it was that the world is changing and their needs and expectations as wealth holders are really shifting. So they're seeking to align their wealth with their values and expect their professional advisors to support them in that. There's a whole other side argument around doing good with money, but harm versus good. So if you look at trusts and foundations, you look at people investing, they may do good in sort of their donations, but they may be investing in things that are doing harm to the environment. So they want to do good with their money. And they basically have said that the professional advisory workplace is falling short on that. And some of them are starting to fire their advisors. So the writing's on the wall, I think, for advisors who don't talk to their clients about their values or motivations or ambitions. And aside from that, with consumer duty and being customer centric, how can you be customer centric if you don't know what people's values are and stuff? So they outlined some of the key obstacles that exist. So it's really quite something. Some of the advisors will say, well, yeah, but they're young, they don't control the money. Well, all of these people were wealth holders, so they control the money. But also, I think they reflect what changes that are taking place. So there's just been a recent study that shows that older people are also starting to pick up on the same thing about money for good and the whole issue of sustainability. And so that's changing. And then I guess there was a third study that we just picked up recently that showed that firms that support their clients, for example, on their value-driven journey, if it's focused on philanthropy and charitable giving, they have 6 times the medium assets of those who don't, 3 times organic growth, 1.3 times their money, and higher trust levels. So to me, why would you not do this? That's what clients want.
It's interesting to hear you frame it in that way, that by listening and responding, you get actually better business. And advisors are also working to build their own businesses,
yes,
and to do good.
But if you don't relate to the people, your clients, you have to understand their values. Do you not do that? Do you get into conversations with your clients about their values and try to help them live their values?
It's something we're quite passionate about. I think people are interesting and you actually want to get under the bonnet and understand what drives them.
Why?
Because you have a better feel for what they need. And our solutions, I mean, this is kind of what GreenGage is about, is our profit is in solving the pain points of our clients. And you can never get to the pain points until you listen. And I think you've discovered something from the other end of the spectrum, if you will, around how do we deliver good through philanthropy by assisting advisors, by helping them to learn how to listen.
But it's not even good through philanthropy. It's good through impact investing as well. It's not bad to make money.
No.
You can do good. You can do this both together.
I'm going to ask you a slightly timely question, the idea of effective altruism. We have our friend Sam Bankman-Fried to thank for popularizing recently.
So what's your definition of effective altruism?
I would ask you first.
No, I asked you first.
What I've understood, and you are the expert here, is the idea of quantifying impact in many ways. So having the delivery of donations be linked to certain objectifiable outcomes.
Yes.
And that is a loaded question back to you then, because there is some good potentially in that, but obviously it's a technical mechanism to deliver good.
Concept makes sense. It's too bad it's being tainted by all the stuff, but maybe people get over that and by the personalities. I think there's a lot of push now for impact, whether it's impact investing or philanthropy impact, whatever. A lot of charities or people measure outputs, which I think are just useless. So 6 people attended this, 12 people attended that. So outcomes are really a little more difficult. Impact is really difficult. The same issues will apply with ESG and impact investing. It's really difficult to measure all this stuff. And that's why your CA, I guess, now is starting to come down hard on greenwashing activities, because that's an issue. I was at a meeting today in Parliament with NPPG on philanthropy and social investment. In the room was a number of really excellent examples of social enterprises doing really good in their communities. And they weren't doing super sophisticated analysis of their impact, but they certainly could explain their impact. And they had some really interesting data about outcomes and stuff. So I think there's some really neat stuff around that. So the concept is good. In the fundraising area, you have major donor fundraisers who use case for support, which is really brilliant. It works. It has an emotive base to it. And people give a lot of money because of it. But I teach an alternative to do a business case.
Yeah.
So 2-page real business case with business case language. So for certain people who are looking at philanthropy, for example, as an investment, not to get financial returns, an investment to get societal returns, some kind or other, a business case is an appropriate approach to take. And for those who are more emotive, then the case for support makes sense. So you should have both in your back pocket. So language is shifting. A lot of young people now see their philanthropy as an investment and they use different language. And if you're not up to date with language, I mean, it's really one of the things we do in our training is we talk about jargon, because everyone's using terms slightly differently. So clients use it differently and stuff. And unless you understand what people are saying, it's going to be pretty hard to communicate.
It's an interesting way to think about. I mean, effective altruism to me is partially helpful. And I think quantifying things and giving people metrics. But at the same time, as you've outlined in the APPG example, it removes the story and the vision and the impact that is not quantifiable. I think going back to the idea of stories having impact, I mean, crypto itself is a story and it has an origin in the libertarian kind of dream of working with the technology to achieve freedom. We're now hitting the big leagues where central banks are deploying solutions potentially even built on blockchain to deliver digital currencies. What do you think the story of crypto is now in your space?
Where is it going?
Yeah, I mean, you have a keen interest.
I do, but I don't know a lot about it. I'm not an expert like you, so I don't, you know, it's still just an amateur sleuth kind of thing. I think that my intuition is that the basis for it, for a lot of people looking at it, libertarian, is going to shift because FCA and other regulators are going to start regulating, which I think is good in a way. Although I'm sure some people will be pissed off, will be upset by that. So I think there's going to be a shift and it'll become much more mainstream, which will be good because you'll get more people involved in it. And it's an interesting way of money around, an interesting way of making money and stuff like that.
Well, I think some of the story, and one of the bits of the breakfast that really intrigued me was the discussion around how actually crypto has been a mechanism for giving. And we discussed the money that was given to the Ukrainian relief efforts through donations in Bitcoin primarily, and also with the Turkish earthquake and just getting money to people quickly.
Yeah.
These technologies allow for that in a way that is difficult using traditional finance.
Yeah.
In terms of the stories that you see, I know we have a LinkedIn group, Crypto Philanthropy, that we've set up together.
Yeah, I should actually plan that more.
I think we all should, but what are some of the themes that resonate with your audience in terms of the impact that crypto can bring to philanthropic giving?
I think there's still that's many stages.
Yeah.
And I was clear in our breakfast that there were some of you who work in the area and you're very enthusiastic about it. There were some people who are very wealthy and play in the area and make a lot of money out of it and quite passionate about it. But we had some people who are traditional at the breakfast in terms of traditional wealth management, and they were intrigued and positive, but I don't think it's going to be overnight where it's accepted. I don't think that what happened in the last year or so is not going to help. But what really amazed me is when we had the breakfast, what do we start off with? Well, we started off with to use a cliche, the elephant in the room. So what happened last year? What's the impact? Let's get that off the table and then let's move on. And people were quite positive about crypto and moving crypto forward, but not ignoring the fact that there's alleged deviance.
Yeah, and there is in any sector. I think it's the responsibility of people to weed them out, and they weed themselves out over time as well.
Yeah.
Which you will have seen, you've seen a few innovations. And I love how you also involved quantum in our discussion.
Yeah.
AI, I'm sure. What are some of the lessons learned you can think from your work?
I think it's really interesting. That chat, whatever it's called,
ChatGPT.
GPT. Yeah. I think it saves time, although I've tried it twice the last little while. I had to put together something, a description of the thing that we're looking at doing. But what the elements are, et cetera, and they used the chat thing. It was perfect. It gave me just about every answer. So before that, I'd done the traditional research, Google, and it was frustrating because it wasn't coming out. So I thought I'd try it. And basically, I was able to develop a really nice one-page answer to everything I was looking for using that. Then I tried it again on something else, and it was a complete bust. So I didn't get anything out of it at all. But I think it's going to help. George Orwell's probably turning over in his grave right now, but I think it helps in some ways. You see things like AI could create you and I on this. Are we really here? Are we real? And stuff. right?
I think when you speak to using these new technologies, if you know how to frame a question, and if you can act as an editor, and you will have this from the wealth of experience you bring, the knowledge to know the structure of what things could be.
Yeah.
Without having that, and I think that's the issue we've seen with our little space, crypto, coming into the big wide world, without having the contextualization of how things are actually delivered, it's great to see new technologies and what they can bring, but to encapsulate them within a story, I think, is when they really sing.
But quantum is going to be quite fascinating. And you combine quantum with AI, and I don't know if that's possible, but if you do, because, I mean, for certain things, well, okay, if we look at advisors, what's key? Technology or relationships? Well, relationships, right? Because you can use technology for certain things, and people are using, and wealthy people are using technology in brilliant ways around managing their money. But it's the relationship that's really key, and that's how advisors are going to survive. So if I'm on the end of one, on the phone with an advisor, and I think they're AI, and then I'm just going to get what you get now, or to get better and better. But when you go on Helpline, or let's say for computers or whatever, and you get these chatbots, those twits.
Well, now they are. I mean, the real question will be, as you've seen with ChatGPT, when it iterates, and the answers that we get back are quite good, does that generate trust? And I think the challenge for professional advisors will be to use these new technologies to deliver excellence, but still deliver it in a trusted.
Well, you want to be first call. You want to be, and if you can achieve that, you've made it.
Exactly.
But I mean, but look at stuff. Okay, look at 20 years ago. Did we have videos? No. Do we have CDs? Not quite. And now, if I want help in taking my espresso machine and to clean it, what does my wife do? She goes on a video. She's younger than I am, and she's an IT person and stuff. So all that stuff. Well, I prefer to sit down and read the manual. So I must be one of the few people in the world that still reads manuals. But that is different styles and different ways of learning. So, but did we use videos a long time ago? No. Do you use videos now for training and stuff? Absolutely. Well, it's not bad.
It's another strain in your brain.
Yeah. And so what's next? So when I was growing up, we had party lines. Do you know what a party line is?
Yes, but thanks to your previous explanation when last we spoke.
And what motivates you to do what you're doing? Because, I mean, you could have been a traditional banker, I guess. I don't know. What did you do before you did GreenGage?
Traditional banker.
Yeah, traditional banker. So why would you shift from something that was well-known, relatively secure, depending upon the bank and the times, to something that was the Wild West and moving away from being the Wild West? So why would you switch from that to that?
I think the reasons you and I get on is perhaps a curiosity and an interest in doing good, but with an eye towards freedom. And I think doing your own thing allows you to have a bit more freedom, but also to build. And that's why I'm enjoying what I do. And I think that's probably perhaps one to get along.
What's the basis of freedom? Why is that so good? I mean, I could see why people would be anti-authority.
I mean, there's various definitions of freedom, I think. If you think philosophically about positive and negative freedom, negative being the freedom from chains, and positive being, very broadly, the freedom through enfranchisement, by being excited about what you do and being part of a community. I think the latter is what gets me out of bed, thinking through how do we deliver something as a legacy at the end of our lives.
Oh, I like stress. I like challenge. So I spent most of my life in Canada going into charities that were facing difficulty and helping to turn them around. Very stressful. I didn't care when I started.
You and me both. I mean, that's fantastic work, though. At the end of the day, you've delivered something real.
Sometimes.
Or you try.
Well, it's high risk, so you never.
You never know, but at least you've made the effort.
Yeah.
And I find that hard to do in the big banks. Not, they're not doing good things, but the level of impact, to use a phrase, that you can achieve in a small organization is quite powerful.
Yeah, it is.
One last bit of innovation that I'd like to touch on is the idea of a charity DAO, which I know we discussed in Bruce, but where a decentralized autonomous organization can be given certain protocols to help the crowd select beneficiaries of the donations, for example, or to shape the nature of selections of donations. You have seen many different types of charitable organization in your day, and this is obviously a purely technical setup, but using people to allow them to take decisions if they participate in the formation of the DAO or the day-to-day governance. Do you think technologies like these, I mean, obviously this is in pilot phase and there's only a couple worldwide. I know the founder of blockchain.com and one of the co-founders has set up a charity DAO that actually is running, which is amazing.
And everyone participates in decisions.
Not everyone. I mean, the governance is specific to the individual DAO and how that works, but it's a level of democratization, which I don't think we've seen in many aspects of the selection process for donations.
It's not extreme without the tyranny of the masses.
One can say that.
Extreme. Let's hope that doesn't happen. But if you look at the statistics for giving, what's the most popular thing? Education, religion, etc. That they're going to go for something that's the most popular because 50 people think that that's better than supporting some kind of thing. And the other issue around this is unrestricted funds. There's a real power imbalance that exists within some situations. And so one of the ways around that is to have unrestricted funds. I mean, that's how we survive as an organization through COVID, with unrestricted funds. So how does that fit in to this? So where's the democracy if someone says to me, you should be spending your money on X, Y, and Z when really our clients need P, Q, and T and stuff? So will that happen with the DAO? How are they going to create that? So I think the idea, the concept is really good. It's going to be in its implementation, I think, will be interesting to see.
Which is a great question to ask, actually a series of questions. Through your experience, you've seen how technologies have been implemented in the past. If a charity DAO gives efficiency but at a cost, it's always about contextualizing in the story, but for use, that is when it actually works.
So you have Twitter, that is really popular. And some people would think it's gone off the rails, some people are fine with it. But does that sort of give a potential parallel example of what could happen in a DAO?
Completely. And I think the editorial function that we were talking about before, vis-a-vis ChatGPT and taking the best of these things, but also giving them shape and form. Yeah. Without that shape and form, sometimes...
But who makes a decision about that?
What you've done with Philanthropy Impact is take a view to help give the advisor themselves the tools to deliver more impact.
Yeah.
And I think what you've seen with these new technologies is that the impact can be delivered by shaping an editorial story.
Yeah.
Giving them additional tools at their disposal.
Yeah.
And it sounds like we agree on that.
Yeah.
I'm mindful that we've danced around a lot and it's been a lot of fun. So, is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
I just think that people have to be open to testing all kinds of neat things. They also have to be open to failing. It's okay to fail as long as you learn from it and grow from it. And sometimes you have to question basic assumptions to do that, which sometimes makes you look comfortable sometimes. But I think that the whole thing that we're doing around working with advisors is really an important part of achieving more and better giving and more and better impact ESG investing.
Completely agree. It's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you. It's been fun.